You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Well, it's very nice to be here with all of you, and especially this diverse group, to hear what you might have to say, to get your ideas about this line of work that I've been interested in. And I'll just kind of tell you a little bit about what I do in terms of my research, and then get into some recent work that was, I guess I would say, 100% inspired by the conference that was here last year on the internet technical strategies and internet safety, and I'll talk about how that came about and how it influenced the research as we go. It'll be pretty clear, I think, judging by the data. Okay, so what I study, I'm actually fairly new into the technology internet landscape of studying. I come from investigating the effects of more traditional media, like violence and advertising, more like on television and in movies, and sexual messages and stereotyping and all of that. But I don't really look at whether or not those effects exist. I've always looked at how people or individuals or organizations put forth strategies to prevent those negative effects. So I work under the assumption that those effects exist or that others establish that those effects exist. And when they find them, I look at what people are doing to try and stop them. And so that's how I ended up over the last 3 or 4 years, becoming more interested in this online space, because most of what I do is working with families and children in schools, for example, and even policymakers on how best to prevent negative effects on kids, how to maximize positive effects of media on children who use the media, and then how to reduce negative effects. So a lot of what I look at is, when I get really excited about, is when these strategies go wrong and why they go wrong. So when children, for example, are likely to resist things that get in their way of their media use, that especially adults try to intervene. And so we say things like, don't do that, I don't trust you, turn that thing off, you're not allowed to do it now. And then we also, all the way up, those are kind of household strategies, all the way up to, in some places, actual censorship. Here we don't have too much of that go on, but we do have, time, place, and manner restrictions and all sorts of other things. And, with the, internet landscape, there's more and more of that coming around, as we just talked about at the conference. So I'm looking at when our efforts to prevent kids, negative effects of the media on kids likely to be met with resistance from the kids, and why that resistance happens, and if anything can be done to prevent this resistance from kids. So that's kind of the big ideas. And today I want to talk specifically about what kids are doing with technology, which many of you in this room are experts on this, what we think they're doing as adults, and then what can we do, if anything, to guide them or protect them from some of these things that are, work under the assumption that these are out there, these effects, and they are real. Just in terms of theoretically where I come from, I'm a communication scholar, so I study messages. This is one of the kind of classic message effects theories, just information source transferring from a source to a destination. And this right here has been there since the early days of communication scholarship. It's called noise. And most scholars look at unintentional noise. So this is unintentional effects of the media. Like if you watch something violent, you become aggressive. Or if you see something sexual online, it's going to make you maybe less or more willing to engage in premarital sex or unprotected sex. Those are unintentional kind of effects of media messages. But I also look at this as, when can we put in deliberate disruption of messages? So when do we try to intervene in message effects, basically, that are going around? And that's kind of my main area. I've worked on models in this area looking at deliberate disruption. And this is what I'm expanding, kind of what I based the research on from my end in terms of the theory that I work from, of identifying an effect that we're worried about, the target, in this case, children, the kind of strategy that might work, interventions, filters, rules, policies, censorship, those sort of things, implementing the strategy, exposing those kids to the message, sometimes, sometimes not, and then seeing if it had any effect, if it worked. So that's kind of the theory of deliberate disruption, or the process anyway. Now, in terms of the perceptions of the problem, and if any of you read the the final report of the task force, you'd notice predators, porn, privacy, peers, piracy, all of these different problems that might come up as a result of children being exposed to the internet. So I don't really need to go into that too much. But those are some of the main concerns. And so what we do about those, there's a whole wide range of strategies. And last year, this unit, this is a slide you all know very well, or should know very well, because it's ripped off right off your website, basically, at least the visuals are, brought together attorneys general from several states, 50 states, I believe, 49. It says 50 in the manual.
52 is actually the true answer, but that's a little puzzling.
I was wondering about that.
The only state not involved was Texas.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Well, but. Texans, go back. Go back and tell them to join. Anyway, we had all kinds of vendors here, and we had some of the social media representing themselves and talking about what they were doing to protect kids. I sat there. I took very good notes on every single time a strategy was put forth that should hopefully prevent these negative effects. And then I asked myself, based on my research, which of these strategies are likely to be met with resistance from kids or from their parents, for example? And in my work, the worst case scenario in a household situation is when parents love this idea and kids hate it, because that's when the kids are going to very easily find their way around it, and that's what you call a totally useless strategy that in some cases they're willing to spend a lot of money on. In terms of the technological strategies, I don't have the data in this presentation, but I asked parents of all those strategies, the technological ones, how much would you be willing to pay for these? And the average that they were willing to pay was $50. So, you know, up to thousands of dollars, some people said. So you don't want to be wasting your money or your time. You want to make sure that the kids don't try to get around this strategy and that the parents think it'll actually work and it's viable for their family, both in terms of how to implement the strategy. And as it turns out, it's really built into the value system of parents, whether or not they think that it matches with their own set of parental values and their parenting style, basically. So I have a lot of data from a national sample survey that I did asking parents many different things, but the main questions that I asked them were about how much do you support, or would you be likely to support this strategy like coming into your household, or if it was, for example, government censorship, how much do you think that that's a good idea or not? And then on a subset of those, I asked kids in kind of a kid version of the question, how would you feel if this thing happened, if your parent did put on this this filter, for example, or if your parents got a mouse that could tell what age you were and put it on your computer, those things that mapped onto the strategies that were proposed at the task force meeting last year. And I'm looking for here points where parents, again, think that these are great ideas and kids think that they're horrible ideas. I also asked, the matched data is a subset of what went on at the task force meeting. I asked parents a lot more questions because they have more stamina to sit through the survey, but also, you know, compared to kids. But I also am curious in understanding how we can predict support for these strategies from just people in general. This sample happened to be parents, but I wanted to know, like, which strategies are the most supported and what kinds of individual differences in people lead them to support different strategies over other strategies. And then I asked also about what kinds of behaviors the kids were engaging in online, and then how often their parents thought that they were engaging in those behaviors online. And a lot of that data matches on with data we already have on a different sample that other researchers have done, but it's just asking the kids that question. So I was interested in knowing, do the parents have any clue? Or does it match in terms of what the parents are doing and what the kids are doing? So there's a lot here. And so what I'm going to do is kind of talk first about the one that's mainly central to my interests. But if you have a specific thing that you want to know, like how much do parents support a certain thing, I could maybe dig that out for you, or at least you could email me and I could get that information for you. But I'm going to start out with, before I go there, with just letting you know what happened with the matched paired scores. So I did a confirmatory factor analysis on this. I'm going to get into some statistics on this for a second and then tell you about the descriptives of it. But I found, and this was confirming factors, that means that I put all of these different strategies out there and how parents answered similarly on different groups of questions kind of means that they conceptualize these things as being sort of the same kind of strategy. And these factors turned out to be very much the same as factors that emerged when we're talking about traditional media, like television, for example. So, for example, the government and industry strategies, the green line is how much the child would be okay with this strategy. The red line is how much the parent would, and this blue is the difference score. And when you go backwards, it means the parents support it more. So there's very little in this whole thing that, as I present the data, where the kids like it more, but there are a couple where the kids actually like the strategy more. And the midpoint on this scale is going to be 3. So you can, right around here is actually on the scale, they say neutral, I don't care one way or the other. And you get parents appreciating a lot more of these strategies than kids. But some big hot spots where we have big different scores. So these are all of these factors, all of these items, such as if the people that make websites watched what you were doing all the time, and that's the kid version of the question, you see that the kids don't like that very much. Parents think that's a pretty good idea. So that is an example of the ones that loaded as industry and government strategies, which tended to load together. And I'm going to kind of go through these pretty quickly, and then we'll pause on some. Household strategies are really things that parents could do in their own household, such as if your mom and dad told you you weren't allowed to go to a certain website until you're older, or if your mom and dad made rules about what kinds of websites you're allowed to visit, the amount of time you're allowed to visit. And kids, you know, hovered right around the midpoint in terms of average scores on these items. Parents really like a lot of these ideas. Technology, and these ones came directly from the meeting. Things like if your computer mouse could tell how old you were and only let you into sites that were good for your age, not much difference, you know, there, not too much resistance there from kids. But kids didn't like if your parents could record everything you do online and look at it later. So this is an example. The longer this blue line is, according to the theories that I work from, the more likely it is that the child is probably going to try to get around that based on a theory called psychological reactance. The more angry they are about it, they're going to try to restore their freedom in some way or another. Another factor was called user or child empowerment. And you can see tiny blue lines here mean that most, and pretty high, going high, like and a little further up from the midpoint, means that both parents and kids kind of like these ideas. And these are things like, you know, your school offered a class on how to be safe online, or if people that make websites put ratings on them to show you how bad or good it is, you could take a picture. There's some items in there about kids taking control of what goes on in this space. So if groups of kids warned other kids, you know, gave warning to other kids who are not acting right online, not surprisingly, kids weren't so resistant to these because it gives them control over where they go and where they're not. So that's nice. It might not work in all situations, but they didn't express as much resistance to those. Parental access was one of the big spots. This is the scale of all three of these items up the top, by the way. But some of these generated, for example, lots of support from parents, almost to the top of the scale. Kids, not so much. They did not like if their parents asked for their passwords to all of their websites and email. Yes? I'm sorry, yeah, it's 10 to 17. Yeah, 10 years old to 17. And I'll get in a second to how that predicts some of these things, these different scores, because it does. Co-viewing, which is basically setting that, this is one of the classic, if you go, just about any children and media communication scholar will tell you things like, don't have the TV in the bedroom where the kid is, and you know, have the computer in the kitchen where you can see it. And these parents like these, again, kids, you know, any parent who has children, including me, will tell you that they will quickly be able to scroll right off of that screen when you walk into the kitchen. But kids you know, again, kind of hovering around the midpoint of neutral on average. Now, remember, this is on average, so when we predict this score here, we're going to be able to predict those ones that are really contributing to this disagreement when we put this into a regression. And the last one are kind of legal ramifications, I call it, though it's not entirely legal. This one really surprised me. Kids actually like the idea of, kids who are mean or bad to others get suspended from school. not as much as their parents. I mean, their parents like it less, of course, because they don't want their own kid to get suspended from school, is what I would guess. But kids, this is one of the only places where kids a little more likely than their parents to support that kind of strategy. Or if kids were bad or mean to others online or arrested. This one about equal between parents and kids. So those are kind of extreme, but certainly there's stories that you might have heard recently in the news. I think California was dealing with an issue like this where the principal was required or asked to suspend or expel a kid who had done some cyberbullying. And so this issue is a legal issue. I haven't followed the case closely enough, but are schools responsible for children's behaviors online when they're at home? I talked to a principal about this at a middle school in Ithaca recently, and he said he wants responsibility. He wants to take that on because he suffers from it when he's at school, when the kids get to school, and all of a sudden a fight will break out in the hallway, and he has no idea because before he could collect the little notes that were being passed around and kind of intervene in it, but now this is all planned out at home. And he said, if it affects the school day, then I want control over it. My father, who's a superintendent of public schools in L.A., disagrees. He doesn't want anything to do with anything that they do at home. And he thinks that that's putting a terrible burden on an already burdened school system, so there's differences of opinion on that. Now, the question is, so here's these blue lines, mostly going in the direction of disagreement toward the parent liking it more. What I've started to do, and I should say, if I did to some of you individually, that these data are really fairly new. I'm just getting into them. But I did try to predict this disagreement score. So what I'm trying to do here is figure out, okay, well, they might disagree, but who disagrees under what conditions? What kinds of families? What kinds of family units disagree on these? And so I've drawn from a few theories and other studies to look at the communicative environment in the household, so the parenting style, how well parents communicate with their kids and how well kids communicate with their parents, their own self-reports of that on certain parenting style scales, values and beliefs and kind of political stance, where you stand on those moral issues scales, and then certain individual characteristics of the child, like how old they are, for example, could predict disagreement, or their gender, and then parent characteristics. And as it turns out, for some of these factors, we can predict it. Parenting style turns out to be a big point of a pretty good contributing factor. So parents who are, for example, overly strict, there's this authoritarian, it's called parenting style. They like to have a lot of control over their child without giving their child much room. That predicts a lot of disagreement. So theoretically, that kind of household should be most at risk for the kid trying to get around these kinds of strategies. On the other side of it, agreement is predicted by households that report pretty good communicative relationships with their parents. So on the variable of how easy is it to talk to your child and how easy is it to talk to your parent, both of those predict agreement. So those kinds of households that are talking to their kids are pretty understanding or I guess in line with how useful they find these different strategies. So when it's hard to talk. Now, one case where I think it's kind of interesting that even this what they call the good style of parenting, which is authoritative, which is where you have a balance of kind of control and listening to your kid, on the technological strategies, there's this parenting style actually predicts disagreement. So where on the other ones, it predicted, we agree. This one, I think it might be because, and I would be guessing, that these kids are used to being trusted. And when a technological strategy is imposed on them, they feel that they'd probably rather talk to their parent and be a little more open with their parent rather than have kind of a filter or a net nanny type of thing that watches their every behavior online. I would guess that might be one reason why it's kind of the opposite with the technological strategies. The value system helped predict certain differences, such as especially the more governmental, outright censorship or industries, like the internet industry taking control of their own content on there. Parents who were more conservative liked that more, for one thing, and also those that had a high value for like household security and those kinds of things on established value scales. Religious, the parents reported that they were predicted a difference of opinion on many of the strategies, actually. So the more religious they were, the less likely their children were to agree with them that some of these would be useful, especially those, again, that were more like technology oriented, not the ones that were about talking to your kid or empowering your kid. And in general, boys just disagree with their parents on just about everything. So that's probably not unique to this particular context. Well, when you control, when you kind of put that in the model, you know, gender up there in the model and control for it, then, so boys are in there, so gender is in there first. So this, all the other things are kind of above and beyond gender. So the value system and those kinds of things would be taking gender out of the equation, basically.
The data, the strategies data. If you took boys out of the sample, how radically would it change the results? The difference is it gets smaller, apparently.
Yeah, probably, yeah. Well, no, I think if you took boys out of the sample, the differences would get smaller, that's right, yeah. I would imagine. I actually haven't done it, so I don't know exactly, but I would imagine that that's what would happen. In terms of what might work best, so these are just places where I saw little resistance from kids, is empowering children to protect themselves, and this runs very similar to what we know already about media literacy programs and traditional media effects, and you know, allowing for, in terms of what would cause conflict in a household, taking some of that onus of responsibility onto policies. And this is very kind of different than I actually thought would happen when I left the task force meeting. I thought we'd get parents kind of wanting that control in their household, but I think if you look at what they both support and where, you know, there aren't as many differences, this actually could be a strategy that wouldn't cause as much conflict in the household, you know, giving websites and maybe some policy protections on kids, so allowing websites to handle some of that for themselves. In terms of what's risky, kids don't want to be watched. They don't want to give away their passwords, that sort of things. These are things that I think if you try to do this, and especially in a household that has kind of a authoritarian, not a very good communication between parents and kids, they're theoretically should be trying to get around these kinds of strategies. And so that's kind of, I guess, where I'll stop with the, in terms of the parent-child reports of the protective strategies. I have also got the data on what are they doing in terms of behaviors, which I think is kind of fun to look at, but maybe I'll, because I don't want to run out of time and leave lots of time for questions, maybe I'll stop here, and then if we want to move on, or if you guys want to go on and look at the behaviors, we can do that. We can do that too. What would people like to do? Okay. Let's look. It's pretty easy to see. So on the one hand, we've got all these great uses of technology that are positive, such as here's some information-seeking variables. Kids are in blue, and I don't know why this went up to 120. I'm sorry about that, but this is a percent of kids who report that they use the internet to do homework, very high. Parents, a little bit lower. I have the actual statistics on which one, you know, most of these, just because of the sample size, come out statistically significant, but how important this difference is, I don't know, but the sample size as high as this. And then in terms of personal health, parents actually overestimate how often their kids go to the internet for personal health. And I should say that the way that I ask these questions ended up being quite useful. I asked these questions on a scale from not at all, I never do it, to I rarely do it, I sometimes do it, I often do it, and I do it all the time. And I actually broke that down into never, as other researchers have just asked yes or no questions. I broke that down into never and ever. And because I think there was a little bit of room for them to answer in the rarely zone, I think some of my data shows they were more willing to say, yes, I do that sometimes, especially when you get to the more negative behavior. So a lot of them report, for example, I don't report this here, but I asked how often have you bought prescription drugs, and I think like 5% of the sample said rarely, whereas before they hardly got anything on that because no one's willing. It's a yes or no question. I'm going to say no because it's hardly ever, for example. So I don't know what that means, but that might be why I get some differences.
The identity development?
Yep.
Is this because the kids aren't marking what they're doing as identity development? Or how is this question?
Yeah, so the question is worded for the kids, how often have you used the internet to figure out who you really are? So it's awkward, and they might not even know what that is, especially
posting to MySpace.
So. No, but I asked a lot. So there's a lot of data there that I haven't looked at all the way around. I just used this kind of one item that was supposed to capture identity development. But there is the question of, do the kids know what they're doing when they're building their identity? I would doubt it. But do they know, you know, how to figure out who they really are? Maybe so. Maybe as they get older, at least. And then here's the parents report that they do that quite often, at least the way it's asked there. And it's worded the same for the parents, actually. How often does your kid use the internet to kind of figure out who they really are? In terms of social relationships, we get actually quite similar results here in terms of how often they use the internet to meet friends and maintain friendships. Often in the case of maintaining, about half the time in terms of meeting friends. But on the negative side, this was some data, and I have the actual data from these two researchers. In terms of cyberbullying, we have kids reporting, so these are again percentages. This matches this previous work by these researchers, and I'll show you their data in a minute. But what they don't have is this parent report. So parents are pretty seriously underestimating how often their kids have been cyberbullied, how often they've cyberbullied others. And here's some specific, I picked a couple off of the scale of cyberbullying. They do seem to, parents understand, or at least pretty come pretty closely to matching their kids on how upset they, when they've ever been upset by it, getting an instant message, maybe because that happens in the household and they can see it for themselves. But again, like the password being stolen.
But these are both, this is all your data. Yeah. Questions are
taken. Yeah, I just took the exact same questions. Okay. And I asked them also to the parents in terms of their awareness. Here's the data from Hinduja and Patchin. So pretty similar, almost exactly in terms of, you know, I've cyberbullied others in my lifetime. And actually this is a little, there are their items. I didn't ask them though in the previous 30 days. I asked them ever. So that's a little bit different too.
Can you define cyberbullying?
It's how often I've been mean to others online.
But
yeah.
These others are people I know or people I don't know?
Or I can't remember exactly how I worded it, but it's people, it's both ways. And I'm reporting to you here the average of people I know and then people I don't know. Yeah.
So you're basically getting an overestimate, which is useful for the...
Yeah, just to see what we get. And then here's that I've been, you know, a victim of cyberbullying. So here, this is their data, again, just as a comparison. And it's fairly close, but again, without the parent, which is a lot lower than some of the than what they got. So that could be useful. In terms of sexual exposure, parents reporting they accidentally run into sex about half the time. Parents thinking it's
running
about...
Running into sex, meaning running into pornographic content?
Accidentally running into sexual messages, sexual images or messages online. And then... purposefully went out looking for sexual images online. Again, you know, with survey data, you never know how honest they're being. We actually did ask the kids at the end, how honest were you? We give a series of, you know, it's okay, we'll never know, you told us you were dishonest, we'll never know where you were dishonest, just were you ever dishonest? And we had about 20 kids admit they were dishonest and we took them out of the survey. So that doesn't mean that the other ones, you know, if you're likely to be dishonest once, you're likely to be dishonest again, but at least we got rid of those 20. Yeah, you're out. Yeah, right. Yeah, I know. It's kind
Step
of
on the trap door, please.
Yeah, exactly. But I do that in all of my research just to get rid of at least some of it. And sometimes it works, like in this case for a few cases, not many, but a few. In terms of being approached by a stranger you thought was weird, that's how I worded it, basically. So kids, again, you know, getting up towards 17%, and parents thinking that that doesn't happen quite as often as that.
So yep. why are the parents thinking it's lower? Is it because they think it happened to other kids, not their kids?
I don't know why. But I can put in some of the other variables to predict the kinds, and I haven't done this yet. I don't know yet. I haven't had time to get to it, but I'm going to put these different scores into similar regression to see what family dynamics, if any, contribute to the different score. So is it like these authoritarian families, again, is it when it's hard to talk to your, you know, parent or kid, again, like some of these same variables that contributed to the different score on the other one, or is it gender driven again? Yeah.
Well, I mean, it might also be just... A misestimation of the absolute amount of the activity, too. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, one question would be to ask, you know, how often do you think this happens, as opposed to how often you think it happens to your kid, just to find out. Maybe
like
they just
the
underestimate
effect.
The amount of it on the internet, and that.
Yeah, we do. I do have some things to measure third person effect, which aren't specific, because, you know, again, you know, this is expensive to run a study like this. Every item costs so many hundreds of dollars. But I did ask in general questions about how positive and negative it is for your kid and how positive and negative it is for kids in general at different places in the survey. And I haven't even looked at that data yet. So I could kind of control for parents who are high in third person beliefs. That could be one thing that would help it. It's true.
Sometimes it's the cyberbullying is high, but the stress generated is not that high, so maybe it doesn't matter.
I didn't ask them. I mean, the questions are worded like, how often were you upset? Yeah. Some of the cyberbullying questions, like, how often have you been upset by an email? So I guess if you were specifically interested in pulling out items that directly ask about how upset or emotional they were, there are a couple of items in the survey that get to that. But I didn't really think of them like that as much as someone. I looked at it more like someone said something mean to them, but you're right, it's a reaction. It's kind of interesting to look at on its own.
Have you tried to ask them, if anybody been bullying them, mm-hmm. asking right after that, how often do you do it to others, so they would equate bullying to them?
Oh, how often have you done that kind of behavior to others? I actually don't remember how it was randomized, the questions, but they are close together. And I think that first came the ones for has anyone done it to you? Okay. Yeah, I think that it goes, but not on purpose. I think just by the way it went, but that's a good point. Questions, yes?
Question from the back channel.
Okay.
Did they look at, or did you look at how the students perceived their parents' technical skills, communication on the internet and so forth? Is there a correlation there?
I asked that of the parents, how skilled they thought their kids were on the internet, but I did not ask that of the, and I asked the parents themselves. I gave them a technological literacy scale, but I didn't ask the child's perception of the parent's skill.
So I think this person was asking about the skill level of the parent.
The parent, I did ask it. I didn't factor it into the, I don't know. Yeah, I haven't looked at it yet, but that's, should be done.
Percentage of families that were not very typical.
This data is garnered from an internet sample, a panel sample, so they judge themselves to be pretty savvy. They all have internet access for one thing, and they all know how to like get an email and take a survey and that kind of stuff. So I would say if you're looking to generalize this across, you know, people that aren't, it's probably not good data for that. I would say mostly it's people that are. I did put into the regression model for different scores on protective strategies the perception from the parent of how tech savvy their kid was, and it did predict different scores on some of the technology variables, so the technology filters and net nanny and like those kinds of things. So if the parent thinks that their kid's tech savvy or judges their kid to be tech savvy, that same variable can contribute a little bit to that kid not liking those technological strategies compared to the parent.
Do you ask what kids do on their own when they think they're being approached by a rich person?
No. Like what kind of self?
What their own strategies are.
No. I mean, I would ask them. Their reports of strategies were very general. Like this would be generally good or generally, like I would be okay with it or I wouldn't. Mm-hmm. And these are, the only thing I think that would be close to that would be some of the like empowerment strategies, like kids watching each other, or kind of me taking control of my own safety, those types of things. But I didn't specifically ask, like, what do you do to protect yourself? No.
I guess I asked this as a mother of a 13-year-old.
Okay.
Who is on Facebook, et cetera. I know. So, and the range you have is ages 10 to 17, which strikes me as a hugely large range mm-hmm. when it comes to, A, the kind of activities and savvy and interest they mm-hmm. have. And I'm wondering if you intend to or have kind of looked at sort of the curve that this might take as the kids go through these various developmental stages, because that's a huge range of developmental.
And I picked that range because I wanted to, because I do developmental work and I wanted to capture that, but I don't have that to present here now in terms of splitting the sample or looking at the trends. I've looked at that very age in there in terms of how it predicts, again, those different scores, and it mm-hmm. does on some. So it predicts agreement with like little kids, for example, will be more agreeable to anything, most of the strategies, whereas older age definitely contributes to like a lack of agreement on the technology strategies and those parent access and parent passwords strategies. But I have a lot more work to do with the developmental trends.
If you want them more as a parent, I can also give you a big stack of other literature in this area.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
One of the things that we do know, for example, is that what we normally mark as cyberbullying is one of the weird things that actually goes up in high school compared to other forms of bullying. So there's actually a whole variety of variations on age that are actually unexpected. But I'm happy to send you the lit review.
Right. One other thing I'd ask, if I could just follow up for a sec, since you brought that up, Dave, is whether you tested whether there's an effect of whether they have experienced bullying in their sort of physical lives.
No.
Through school.
I wish I did.
And how that would affect how they respond or what bullying looks like to them online.
We had it, and it's just one, we had many things we had to take out at the end.
Yeah, there's so much that goes into this.
Yeah, but that, I would love
sort
to know.
Floating variables, but
that
yeah.
difference. It's interesting.
And there's actually, Michelle Ibarra has done a ton of this.
Oh, okay.
There is a lot of great work out there on cyberbullying. It's building by the second, so. Let's see what else I've got. And because my very close friend Tarleton Gillespie studies this at Cornell, I asked about how often do your kids download music illegally, and there's very little awareness of that going on. And I asked this of kids several ways and took the average. So
we've done a lot of studies on this too, or
this
a series of ways of asking. Can you say how you asked the question of kids? Because there's some confusion about what's
appropriate. I wanted to preface before I even put this there that I have doubts that this even captured it well. I don't even know that they know when it's illegal.
Yeah.
And so I said things like without pain and knowing that it's wrong. And I can send you the exact questions and even means and difference in means and that kind of thing if you're interested in seeing the difference between those. But I think if I had to guess, that this probably includes some legal downloading too, rather than this, and parents being a little bit more aware of what's actually illegal. But that I would be guessing based on what it is. But the items, I'm not sure.
I think it's wishful.
I think it's interesting
that
you're. Yeah, it's probably a little of both. Probably maybe a little overestimating by the kids and less by the parents. And then in terms of. And what I'm doing next is looking at predicting these, what I call clueless parents, so what can predict these scores, the developmental stuff. And then I have a larger sample of 1,800 parents that I asked all about all these strategies, and just looking to sort of replicate a study that I already did in traditional media of looking at what types of people, what individual characteristics predict support for different kinds of strategies on a larger scale. Again, there's no children matched up with those people, but to see what's there. And then I have I'm working on a grant proposal to develop a social network site with the engineering school that's called First Step, which is a learning networking site of how to negotiate around some of these issues that come up here, like cyberbullying, for example, that you do it. It's designed for third graders to join a social network with their friends in their class. And in that classroom environment, they have this social network where they're presented with certain kinds of lessons that go through like something like cyberbullying or privacy settings, and so they learn some of the consequences and some of the great things about social networking sites, but also some of the consequences. So that is most of my work is actually experimental. This was the first study that I did that was a large kind of sample survey like this. So that's randomized groups in schools in the field, which is what I'm that's more my comfort zone. Actually, my husband and I are doing a collaboration right now where we gave 70 of his students iPhones fully loaded with internet access and all kinds of stuff, and he's using it for his technology to use as an instructional tool in his classroom, and we're looking at the differences that go on with having some of that technology and not. So those are some other things that I have going on also. And it's been pretty fun. So if you have any questions on how that's gone, it's kind of good too. So I guess other questions.
One of the big theories in the space is that we've touched on various ways. Not all kids are created equal with respect to having good skills in this area to keep themselves safe and so forth. Based on what you've seen so far, would you think that the general feeling. Our colleague Esther Hargitay works on this, Henry Jenkins, as you know, that there's a really big divide, that the participation gap is the thing we should focus on, that there are sophisticated kids on the one end of the spectrum who are going to be fine, and then unsophisticated kids may be overlapping with the at-risk kids from other factors, you know, who are going to have a hard time anyway. No, that's not really the focus of what you looked at, but did you see any evidence of that kind of a spread, and whether or not you think that's a likely
I think that that's very likely. I haven't focused on looking at that, but I would say that I think I care about that, and I want to try and look at that. And it has to do, I think, with this idea of the family dynamic in my work, like of how, what makes, so to me, it's all about what do you mean by sophisticated? Is it access? Is it that they don't have parent support or anyone to look after them?
I think much of the theory is to say, forget access for the moment, that there's access and there's access.
Let's talk about everyone that has access. So I'm more concerned about, so in that household, what types of family dynamics would predict, you know, kids getting themselves into trouble? So I would say that in that sense, like it's heavily, I mean, I'm really interested in that. What do I think is going on there? From the data I have here, with my own 10-year-old, I've been really working on talking to her a lot because I think that these reports from the kid about how easy it is to talk to their parents, I mean, they're kind of, you know, pretty strong, strong predictors all the way across these different strategies of different scores. And so it's not a surprise. I don't think it's like, oh my gosh, what a counterintuitive finding that, you know, parents, kids who can't talk to their parents don't like what their parents are going to do. At the same time, when you look at it from the other side, of kids who do find it easy to talk to their parents are more likely to be willing to protect, let the parent protect them, or for example, or let a website protect them, or let the policy protect, let anything protect them. It's kind of interesting that it travels across all of those areas. So I don't know if that answered your question.
Could you go back to that slide of the strategies? I have some questions. Yeah, the first one when you...
All the way up?
Yeah. So when you put the strategies and what the pay... The, yeah.
These?
One more, I think. Yes. No. Yeah, this one.
Okay.
So are these differences... Actually, it was not that. Was one more that... Yeah, that.
Yeah. Okay.
So are those differences statistically significant?
Yes, so for example,
it seems that the children, they have more aversion to that techniques that are related to their privacy, such as the technical nanny thing.
Let me see. Oh, okay.
How do you see that? Because some of them, that maybe even the previous slide, that the difference were like 3 or 2 or 4, and there was just one that was a huge one.
Parent could record, or mom and dad blocked the internet rather than the mouse. This is a screening program. Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, they didn't factor separately, but they do look different on here. I don't have the statistics on which is, I only have the statistics on the scale, and that is a significant difference. But I have them back in the office. So if we wanted to look
it's just to understand better, like, are these really representative, and did the kids report what they would do in this kind of situation? And if there are some factors that you already understand that if you deal with that, it's going to be a failure, you know, such as your privacy, you know, like to have the...
So I hope it's clear that I'm saying that theoretically it would be a failure, not definitely, but when you have another work with, you know, parent and child dynamics, when you have this kind of child getting angry and parent really thinking something's great, that's a bad situation in terms of what might happen, especially from the kid's side. And it doesn't even really matter what the parent's doing. It's something that the parent, or how much the parent likes it. It's just that I look at that, how much the parent likes it, as it being more and more likely for them actually to try and do it.
Yeah.
And so that makes it more likely.
But for example, if you just get the sample that, okay, this family is a good family because they talk a lot, and then you ask the kids, okay, even if that's the situation, are you more angry with things that deal with your privacy, or are you more angry with things that deal with your possibility of accessing technology? So this is a little bit...
So because the kids...
What they value more, the kids.
Yeah, yeah, which one. I mean, I would love to know more specifics about that. Not, I mean, I guess actually it's kind of more broadly. Do you, you know, not necessarily... I asked them about real specific strategies, mm-hmm. and again, I can only ask the kids so many because they get sick of it answering. But the parents I could ask a lot more to. But I would like to, you know, like say that... we were interested in next, just really looking at the technology strategies. And then I would imagine that we would find groups of technological strategies that were very different. But when you look at all of them together with the policies and the other things, these factor together. But if we had more technology strategies and looked at the variation between those, I would imagine we'd get some that were more similar than others. Yeah. And probably they would not like the ones that were more intrusive on their own privacy.
I'm wondering, do you have any socioeconomic data?
I do.
Oh, okay.
I have a little bit. So the way that it's measured, I mean, I have income, I have, you know, I have their census area, their zip code, I have quite, not, you know, that the education level, all of that stuff. I haven't, I mean, I have it built into the regression model, but it's like income doesn't really predict different scores except with the industry and government. So... those people with higher income are parents are more likely than their kids to want to have like industry or government look after them. But other than that, it didn't come out as a variable that predicted anything else.
You don't see any correlation between say income and sort of communication style, family communication.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know exactly, but probably. But I don't know. I haven't looked at those two things exactly. But I could look. It'd be very easy if you're interested in that. I have the data there. So if you want to email me and say, like, hey, what's the, you know, let me know what the correlation is between the income and those parenting styles. I have, like, the whole correlation matrix. I just don't know what the correlation is right now. Yeah.
On that line, I was sort of wondering whether about the parents identified whether they went to private school or public school and if their kids went to. Which kind of school they went to?
You know, I don't have that in my data set, but I believe that they have that information about the panel. So I could go back to the company that gave me the data and ask, like, if that was of interest to see, you know, are there differences between private schools or charter schools or public schools? I think I remember, I didn't ask them to pull that for me because they have all of this data on the sample. I just asked for income and education and things like that and, you know, census region, that sort of thing. What do you think of the school, I was curious, those of you that are from the public school area, what you think of the schools being responsible for what happens at home online, or if anyone has any thoughts on this?
Well, in Boston, we've been working for the last 5 years on a cyber safety project, and thanks to Microsoft, we got some funding to get going on it, and we created the students have done it all. They created cyber safety heroes. They were called superheroes until we just got a letter from Marvel Comics saying that we had this trademark.
Cease and desist.
They will be all cyber safety heroes momentarily. But basically, the students created these wonderful characters to help teach children about internet safety. And we're on this child empowerment track because you can't watch your children all the time. Mm-hmm. And our families don't have access. Families don't know what the children are doing. They don't know. A lot of them don't know. So we need to empower the children. And so we've been mostly doing it outside of, during the summers. But we're moving into a big push now to do it in during the school day.
Okay.
And,
yeah.
Do some more.
Well, if you look at, you know, this one item of groups of kids give warning to other kids or your schools offer classes, these types of things, they did not load into school, like as at school, but it doesn't mean that, I mean, they do have very little different scores in terms of parents and kids both thinking that they're okay. They're not not too bad.
They just don't want more questions.
They don't want more math. That's all. No. Yeah, so that's good. That's interesting.
Do you have any, or either you or Dan or anybody else, have any sense about that 17% figure of weird? weird people approaching you? Weird strangers.
Who are these people?
Weird strangers. So if they're weird, but siblings, you know, or something.
Right.
And the kids had really sharp analytical minds, they might answer no. I'm just trying to figure out what your impression of that is.
Going on?
I mean, is that underreporting? Is it overreporting? Are the people who are weird not necessarily dangerous? Are they like Nigerian scam artists? Or I mean, you know, what do you think of that number?
About this after, so I think she's going to have a lot to say on this. But okay. I was able to do some in-depth interviewing with kids on the iPhone study with middle schoolers, and we did ask them this kind of same question, and to hear their actual responses, in my experience, and it was a very small sample, it went something like this: oh yeah, it happens all the time, but I know those are weird. I mean, I would never do that. I would never engage with those people. And so, I mean, maybe this comes down to those that are well prepared and those that aren't. And the ones that I was talking to seem to be a little bit more savvy or prepared and just filtering and knowing when not to engage. But I don't know what.
So both CCRC and ISK have surveyed on these questions and found that you have a huge number that have received contact from a stranger that they denote as weird. But the fear factor is actually extremely small percentage of that. I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head. So they dove deep into it. And what we end up finding is that because of the frequency of spamming, so a very classic scenario, sketchy looking fake girl profile created on Facebook or MySpace sends you a friend request. It ends up fitting into this. The kids think it's a stranger. They think it's somebody they don't know. They don't realize it's a scam artist, so they don't even read it that way, but they put it in this bucket of weird stranger, but they don't see it as risky or dangerous. And so the ones you end up worrying about, and the way that ISK and CCRC are looking at it, is let's actually carve out the things that they're worried about, and that's actually a much smaller percentage, and those tend to be repeated. So it's somebody who has, for whatever reasons, targeted them and comes at them repeatedly.
And if Jeff Hancock comes to give a lunch here from Cornell, he does a lot of work with deception and the way that someone who was a predator would contact a child would be, like, first in kind of an anonymous space, so a chat room, which often these kids aren't in, these kind of just chat rooms where you could meet people. And then they have a certain process of contact. And he's going to be the expert to tell you how that works, to deceive kids into becoming more trusting and that sort of thing. And those are certainly going to be kids who are, I mean, they're usually going to be kids who are already in trouble in their life. They look for kids who are already weak in other areas, and then they know how to kind of get.
Right, and then the other question is the stranger, non-stranger thing. I mean, the danger, if you took the dangerous contact category, right, would this tend to underestimate that by ruling out all
just
of
any other stranger?
Yeah, any non-strangers who are dangerous who are contacting them.
And I do have this kind of other data that I haven't looked at yet. That kind of differentiates between, like, did you ever have anyone you kind of knew ask to meet you, but I didn't ask that stuff to the parents because the parents, you know, just. I didn't waste the questions, so I figured maybe they'd tell or didn't tell. I didn't know, but it's just like a little more detail on that, and I haven't looked at that.
No, you're being very good about not saying anything that you don't actually know.
I'm sorry. I feel like there's a lot that I don't know from the data because there's so much there, and I don't want to. I know that's probably frustrating, but that's the way it is.
What the whole concept of being approached, it has totally changed from how we typically think about it. I mean, I've worked in middle schools and high schools. When you talk to kids about methods of communication, they're very hierarchical in terms of what method of communication is used at what level of intimacy.
Yeah.
And so that's totally changed. Like, email's really just for school and for talking with other adults. You know, Facebook is for everybody, you know, but then to take that step from being approached on Facebook to some other level of communication, I mean, most kids perceive that as a huge leap in intimacy to go from that space to even texting with somebody or something like that. So it's... But the medium has become sort of, the intimacy is the medium now, the way they think of it.
Yeah.
So the whole concept of being approached is
like where
is,
and
is
when
weird.
And
it's
very hard to capture in a couple of survey items. I agree.
On the cyberbullying, did you ask any kind of questions? Did it initial bullying happen live in school and then cyberbullying, or vice versa?
No. Also, it's just things like. you know, did you ever get an email that upset you? Did anyone ever try to steal your password? It has nothing, there's nothing in the questions about real life.
And also, did you ask any questions, was it cyberbullying first, and then they took it as an...
But I could look and see if they, if there's a person, we could know if there's someone that admitted to both. And we couldn't make any assumptions of whether or not those two things were related, or they were engaged in some kind of cyber bully fighting online, but we could see if there's, if it's true, and I haven't looked at it, but if it's true that those are, who are cyber bullies are also more likely to be cyber bullied, you wouldn't know the causal direction, but you could see that from the data.
Is there any data on how the kids are accessing the internet? It could be like through their mobile phone, through the computers at school versus the computers at home.
I asked them about school, home, and friend's house.
Okay. Nothing about like mobile devices, you know, because people can cyberbully directly from their cell phone rather than having...
I don't think I asked directly about mobile devices. I don't remember doing that, so I don't think I did. Yeah, and maybe like I. But the reason I'm pausing is because I ask questions like, "How often have you accessed the internet at school? How often have you accessed the internet at a friend's house?" So I'm realizing as I'm talking to you that I didn't say like on a computer. So it could be that they're actually answering about being on a mobile phone, and I just kind of realized it just now. Yeah.
I noticed in the earlier graphs where you're listing the differences between. Even in the areas where the differences were low, it seemed like the strength of children's support for a lot of these ideas, even the ones that were close, were not all that strong. You're looking at,
like, they never go above
right, they
that.
Never seem to go like above about 3.6, somewhere around there.
Well, they like the go. This is kind of interesting. I think that the highest, the highest one is.
Right.
Kind of, we want the government to protect us.
Criminals on the internet.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
Well, that's good.
I was like, really? You'll grow up and you'll change your mind.
but I was not that I'm expecting you have data on this, but I just wonder if you have any thoughts on the fact that even though it seems like. A fair number of kids reported being cyberbullied. A fair number of kids reported being approached by weird strangers and all these things. It doesn't seem like kids really want a whole lot to be done when it comes down to any specific.
Well, on average, they don't. But for example, what you just described, those kids, I can know those that have been approached by a bully. If are those the kids who? Would prefer to have, like, are they the ones that are higher on these scales? So in a, you know, you can look at the standard deviations here and see that, at, like, on something like this, it's still, I mean, this is going to go up pretty high.
Yeah.
And so there are going to be kids who are, like, answering fives on this. And so are those the kids who have been harmed or felt that they've been put in jeopardy in the past? I don't know. I hate to say that again. But it's possible to see that from the data. Maybe one of your postdocs can... Take it on. Yeah.
Do you have a sort of marketing strategy in mind for this about how to get this information out to parents and potentially to some of the, you know, older kids who would be at these ages? I mean, how are you going to be able to?
So I do outreach. Right now, it's pretty local. And so first, I would want this to all be peer reviewed and, you know, published in a journal so that it had some validation of being worth something. And then after that, then I look at kind of prescriptions for what I would tell parents. And usually what I try and do, and I'm very sensitive because I worked for my master's thesis was on media literacy, and there were parents who just don't like, I discovered very quickly, there are parents who do not want their kids to learn. They don't want anyone else to teach their kids about anything that has any kind of moral you know, implications. And something like media literacy, teaching kids that violence is bad or advertising is this, or it does. And so they'd rather not see that in school. They'd rather have these responsibilities be given to them or the government or someone else. And so that's kind of how I started getting into this area. And so I have to always start with, you know, it depends on your family, it depends on your values, it depends on your communication with your kid, which kind of strategies are going to work best for your household. So it depends on the audience and all that, but I do... I mean, luckily I'm at an institution at Cornell that highly values outreach and getting work out there for people to use. It's part of our job description, and so and that's why I love it there so much and chose to go there. But there will be. I don't know how that will come about or in what manner, but it will certainly start throughout New York State at going giving talks at PTAs and things. Yes, unless you have any ideas. Okay. Yeah. I'm sorry, there's a question down.
No, go ahead.
So if I understand, I may be misapplying something you said at the beginning too broadly, so you'll let me know, but you're particularly interested in strategies that that don't work because parents love them and children don't, on the grounds that the children are more likely to circumvent. If they hate the strategy, they're more likely to circumvent, so it's not likely to be as effective.
That tends to be the area that I'm kind of get the most fascinated about in my research, of understanding the mechanisms for that kind of situation where the parent would like something and the kid wouldn't, basically I study when kids resist things that are supposed to be good for them. This is what the mobile phone study is about. It's a health study trying to get kids to eat breakfast in the morning, and can we use mobile technology to help increase positive health behaviors, for example. And so when these things that are supposed to be good for them are met with resistance, so for example, in my early media literacy study, I found that a lesson that was trying to get kids to be less aggressive, so teaching them critical thinking skills and then exposing them to violence, was supposed to theoretically make them less aggressive. They would have some personal skills. They became more aggressive. And so I've done a lot of work then trying to understand what is it in messages that sets off your population in the wrong direction. And I discovered there that using violent clips as examples in a lesson, they're not going to listen to a teacher when they can sit there and watch a bunch of violence. They just focus on the violence and they get more aggressive. So that's kind of how, my lip's bleeding, sorry. That's sort of how I got interested in it. And I still remain on that kind of path of looking at resistance. And so one more thing about that is that I kind of find a lot of, hope. I've come across people who have a lot of hope in different strategies, thinking that this is one thing is going to save us. And I find that usually with everything that you find hope in, there's a kind of a side where it could cause damage. And so I caution. I do a lot of cautioning of things like media literacy. And I mean, hopefully your strategy works, but I think it's important to think through what may happen that may not be so good. For example, are we going to give kids values that we should all be online, like we should be on Facebook before we're ready, for example. If you give this idea that everyone, if you are teaching kids that this is what you do online, maybe it's, for example, my 10-year-old hears what I discuss all the time, and she thinks now it's completely normal for kids to be on Facebook, but she's 10, and she's waiting for the day just because she hears about it a lot. So these kinds of ideas that can set off in a kid's head may not be necessarily right for them. So that's what I kind of do, I guess.
Right. So obviously, this is an obvious statement, but to take these towards policy, decisions about which strategies to adopt, we would need at least a third vector, which is how circumventable. Some of these things are easy to circumvent. Some would be pretty hard to circumvent.
Okay. Then in that case, I'd say that I've talked a lot about today about the child's resistance. One of the, and I have kind of a little list of problems with strategies, and the other problem is kind of public support. And so, you know, where you might not get any resistance from the child, as we see in this one, or not much anyway, government keep criminals off the net. Well, you can imagine that there's a lot, you all know, there's a lot that goes into that in terms of privacy, and getting criminals off the internet is not, just because it's easy here doesn't mean it's going to be easy on a lot of other levels, and not only in terms of what, and parents there, they might like that strategy, but not our whole society. So it's about support, it's about reaction, it's a kind of multifaceted look at when these things might go wrong.
So what I'm suggesting, I think, is the obvious fact that if people keep adult stuff off during the daytime, only make it available at night, easy to circumvent, you stay up at night, besides any other problems.
Right here. So if the government only allowed websites they think are bad for kids to be online.
Whereas the websites watch what you're doing all the time. If that were to happen, if it got enough support, if it were to happen, it would be very hard to circumvent, because how do you stop, you know?
Yeah, so that has a different problem.
Yes.
I would say that their challenge there is not in circumvention. And I kind of focused on that today because I'm talking about the parent-child data. But if that's kind of why I did the whole 1800 sample of just parents. I'm interested in knowing kind of broadly about the different policies and different ideas here, what predicts support and what predicts resistance on the parent, on the, I mean, they all happen to be parents because that's what I have access to, but really I don't care about that. I would love to actually have parent and non-parent samples and just see what kinds of individual characteristics predict support for policies. I mean, it's just a situation that I think is kind of interesting.
We have time for one more question?
Yeah.
So while you're here.
Quick, twofold, kind of in terms of what was captured in terms of a general sense of rebelliousness. For example, like you mentioned, what's good for you. But what if, you know, I guess the messaging is don't do this, and then it's a child, whether they have an open relationship with their parents or not, they're more likely to do what is harmful.
So, in I think this is what you're asking. Hopefully, tell me if it's not. I'm sorry. That the deal is that with parents who have an open relationship with their kids, or their kids at least report that it's easy to talk to their parents, those kids are less likely to disagree with their parents on how useful these different things would be. So, because it's just kind of a correlation, it could be that they agree that they're not so good. It could be that they agree that they are good. So there's something about that conversation that makes them more similar to their parents and their attitudes about these things, I guess. So it's not, it's really, and if I said it, I misspoke, that it's not that those guys like everything together. It's that they kind of travel on the same path of attitude. Is that kind of what you were asking? No. How that fits in terms of parenting conversation?
It was
close enough? Okay.
So, I want to thank Sahara for coming and presenting here. Also, for those of you who are interested in this area of work, you should know that J.P. Erz and I are working on a youth and media policy initiative that is very much focused on this area. And we're happy, we've been working on various lit reviews to sort of get a sense of all of the research in this space, which we will be bugging you for more data very soon. So for anybody who is interested, feel free to drop me a note, and I'm happy to send you everything we have. And my email is just Dana, D-A-N-A-H, D-A-N-A-H, at cyber.law.harvard.edu. But thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.